Hey, everybody, and welcome to The Blind Ambition with Jack Kelly. It's your friend Rick from Blind, and today I have the honor of introducing Andrew Duncan. Andrew Duncan is the CEO and managing partner of Infosys Consulting. He leads the Infosys Consulting business globally, which helps drive transformative strategy and innovation for some of the world's largest brands as one of the top management consulting companies. Andrew earned an electrical engineering degree from the Imperial College London. His impressive career includes serving in managing director and CEO roles at several technology and services companies and as a partner at A.T. Kearney. Thanks for coming on the show, Andrew.
Hey, you're welcome. Nice to be here, Rick.
So I am very impressed by your background. Once I've heard about it, we definitely wanted you on the show. So can you walk us through your career arc? How did you get started in consulting as an electrical engineer?
Well, yeah, it actually started because I was an electrical engineer. I mean, I was with Rolls-Royce, not the cars, the aircraft engines, and as an engineer and just learning the trade of engineering. And I was at Imperial College in London, and I was hearing about all these colleagues of mine and friends going off to consulting businesses with very exciting futures. And I'm stuck in Derbyshire doing engineering. And I sort of looked around and went, I want to try that. So I actually went and interviewed and joined Arthur Andersen back in the 80s, late 80s, while it was still a brand you wanted to be associated with. In those days, it was Big Eight, and they were one of the big ones. And so joined their consulting arm, was with them in London for a couple of years before being transferred out to the States, did a couple more years with them. And I was at the time I was working with a platform called, well, two platforms, the System 38 and the AS400. And it was because of that latter experience, they pulled me into the States because I was one of the few people who understood how the whole thing worked from that electrical engineering background. But anyway, from there, joined Coopers & Lybrand for about 4 years, ran a piece of their Southeast US business. Then from there, basically as the PW transaction happened around Coopers, Kearney had been trying to headhunt me for about a year, and so finally pulled the trigger and said, right, I'm here, I'll come. And that was it was fortuitous in that it was the late 90s, sort of 97, 98. And it just as the whole internet was warming up and sort of the World Wide Web and everything was exploding. And I had a couple of very interesting clients, sort of Barnes & Noble being one of them, you'd know back in those days. A bit of Amazon, 1-800-Flowers, a whole bunch of sort of very trendy sort of internet businesses that I was basically front and center in. And so Kearney made partner, did another couple of years with them. And then the dot-com thing really exploded and decided to go have some fun myself with a couple of old Arthur Andersen friends of mine. And we set up a business called Adjoined Consulting. And through about 6 or 7 years, we built a thing from a standing start through several machinations into a $1.2 billion business, which was eventually sold to Capgemini. I left after about a year of Capgemini, went into private equity for a while, actually, both doing a bit of advisory, then joined Alex Partners in London, back in Europe, spent a couple of years with them, then back into a bit of private equity. And about 4 years ago, I returned to consulting with a vengeance, back with Infosys Consulting. Actually, I was convinced to do so by an old colleague of mine from A.T. Kearney. So there's the backstory to all this is that be careful who you deal with as you go through your career, because you're probably going to bump into them numerous times sort of as you get to the later stages of your career. But you know, the consulting industry is very intertwined, and I've been very fortunate to both know and work with some extraordinary people over time.
So Andrew, for people who are interested in being a management consultant, there's not just one type of work you do, right? Is there a way that you could kind of share with the audience, people who are interested in moving into this kind of space, what it's all about and what kind of skills they would need to transfer over?
That's a really good question, Jack. So you've got, there is a spectrum of what you look at consulting in general terms. I mean, you've got your McKinsey, A.T. Kearney, BCG types, but there's even nuance there. I mean, you've got strategic consulting firms like a McKinsey. You have operational and strategy firms like the BCGs and the Kearneys of the world. You then have probably your big four would be a sort of the next on the gamut, which are sort of They can do operational strategy, but they're also then morphing more into the technical space. You then have your classic technical consulting businesses, which do exactly that and exactly what they say on the tin. You sort of get further embroiled into more sort of basically systems integration and then outsourcing. And outsourcing being sort of the actual run component. So you design, you build something, and then someone's got to run it. And a lot of the outsourcing side is run by the actual integrator, which is very similar to the business I work for at the moment. and then on the sort of the far extreme, you've got sort of the process outsourcing and pure technical outsourcing businesses, and that's all they do. They don't get into sort of solution design or delivery or any of that. So there's a whole spectrum of consulting. And then over that, you have professional services, and sort of those would be lawyers and accountants and architects and stuff. But in my dimension of the professional services world, that is management consulting, you have strategy on one end and probably sort of hardcore outsourcing on the other end of the spectrum.
And for you personally, are you dealing with more of the management consulting, the offshoring or the outsourcing of different technology to help out different companies?
That's a good question. So I actually sort of without doing too much of a sales job or emphasis here, but the Infosys consulting unit is really designed as the sort of the tip of the spear for the business. We've got a lot of business consultants sort of within the business, and we help shape and architect the narrative around large transformations. And those transformations may be dealing with part of a business or the whole business end to end. And as you go through those sort of discussions, you have the sort of creation of the design of the solution, the architecting, and then you pull in all the necessary pieces. And then it ends up with having sort of both delivered it, built it, but also then has to be run. And Infosys, as a business, we actually do pretty much the end-to-end. The piece we don't do is really the front-end high-level strategy work. We have ecosystem partners, depending on the circumstance. It could be a McKinsey, it could be a Kearney, it could be an Ernst & Young even, who you could probably look at me and go, well, hang on, some of them will compete with you. And in the old days, that was very much the way to look at it. But nowadays, I think ecosystems have become quite fungible. So we may compete with one day and they're our partner with a client in another day. So, you very much learn sort of what you're good at and what you're not good at, and where you're less good at something, you look to others, both traditional and non-traditional, to partner with you to deliver the best you can.
So that's really interesting. So what'll happen is this: it sounds like you may come in to an engagement and you focus on X, but at the same time, you'll bring in E&Y or PwC or someone else because they have some other, you know, capabilities that complement what you're doing, so that you offer kind of the suite of services to help a client. And so they feel comfortable. Okay, hey, we're not just relying on one, but we have now kind of a whole team that's helping us out.
Yeah, 100%. So if you are, I'll give you an example. So if we're undertaking a big financial transformation for a front to back of a treasury function, we can come in and we can sort of educate a client in terms of what the art of the possible is, in terms of the solution. And indeed, we'll even sort of create a narrative around why you'd even want to go down that journey. So you're talking of outcomes and value propositions, and is it going to sort of help you get more efficient? Is it going to raise basically pump up the stock price? Is it going to help you sell more? It has to be defined in business terms, but fundamentally, you're undertaking a transformation of a part or all of the finance function. Now, Infosys can do a lot of things, and a lot of integrators can do a lot of things. But one thing that we are not is a set of accountants. But if you're going to want to sort of basically overhaul or transform a finance function, you probably need to bring in some pretty specialist accounting skills to do that. So there is an example where we'd reach out to probably one of the big four and basically say, guys, we're in this pitch with a client, or we're in this situation with a client. We've got the technology piece, sort of the architecting piece, but we need the content, the core expertise around accounting and finance function. And that's where you, as an auditor or a tax advisor or whatever, can bring something to the table. And we do that probably more times than we don't, to be honest.
All right, this might be a silly question, so guys, don't make fun of me. But is there something like a type of project that you look at and you just get really super psyched about it? You know, there's some things that you know, when you get a remit to do something and you're like, yes, and you can't wait to do it. What do you have?
Yeah, no, there is. I mean, I spend a lot of my time in the pharmaceutical world and consumer mm-hmm. goods, and a lot of situations I get involved with is where we're putting in the infrastructure to turn on a plant that is either delivering a new vaccine or delivering a new product or whatever, and it's pretty much soup to nuts. And your piece of it, sort of putting in the technology infrastructure or whatever that may be, an ERP system or specialist planning system or whatever, it is absolutely on the critical path to turning that plant on. So you're not only, you're doing something very, very important and influential within the business, but it's also on the critical path of allowing the business to really accelerate or achieve whatever goal that they're looking to achieve. And it gives you that sense of, you're building something, you can see the output, which is in this case, the plant or the facility. And you look at it and you go, yeah, actually I moved the needle on that. And it's, as opposed to, I mean, there are projects you get into where it's, and I don't want to sort of put the finance profession into a dark space, but when you're doing a lot of finance transformations, you're doing stuff which is sort of under the covers and you don't get a lot of the visual format. But if you're doing something in consumer goods for the large part, or indeed in pharmaceuticals, you're making a very visible difference, even though it may not be quite as important as the work you may do in the underlying finance function. The visible bit gives you a charge.
It's tangible. You see it. Is.
And you get home and your kids go, Dad, what do you do? And you go, well, I helped turn that plant on over there. And they go, oh, I get that. We go, well, I helped restructure the chart of accounts for a bank. And they go, what's a chart of accounts?
So is there a typical profile for a client that turns to a management consulting? Right. Just to give you some context on Blind, the perception of management consulting is a bit not the best, right? It's kind of ridden with this anxiety of, oh gosh, well, my company is turning to management consultants because we haven't been able to figure out a problem internally. Or alternatively, it's, oh, these are the guys that are coming to tell my CEO, my CFO, how to lay people off, right? And so if we're working with management consultants, it's kind of like the doom bells, right?
I'm glad you asked this question, because I'm saying the same thing, right? It's like, when you come in, when the manager, right, Andrew, when you guys come in, and they're like, uh-oh, right? All the people in the office, like Rick is saying, yikes, uh-oh, what does this mean?
Well, they have. I mean, they've definitely been firms I've worked for that our job was restructuring and turning around businesses. So you show up and everybody runs for cover because they're thinking that restructuring is about to happen.
What do you do? And do you have to somehow show them, wait, no, we're not, here to let people go. We're not here to point fingers. We're trying to help. Is it kind of, do you have to really come across it in a very soothing, comforting way? So right away they could say, okay, we can relax. We're not going to stress out. They're here to help.
It depends on the circumstance. So, yeah. I mean, if a business is, under intense distress, then there's not a lot of option. It is what it is, and you've got to deal with it quickly. If a business is running out of cash, again, you haven't got a lot of options. You've got to deal with it. If you're more into transformation, we don't really focus on the, right, I tell my teams not to focus on the sort of basically the core bits of a restructuring that would enable the transformation. It's actually look at the business outcome. So why are you doing the transformation in the first place? What are you looking to achieve? Are you looking to drive sales? Are you looking to drive profit? Are you looking to get a better return on your assets, better returns on investment, increase stock price? Put up something tangible around it that not only the executive suite can point out and go, this is why we're doing that, but you can also align people behind it, saying that, yeah, this is, we're doing this particular transformation to, say, lift revenue. And you convince the stakeholders or the exec to actually incent the team to help deliver that outcome, which is going to lift revenue. Because if you lift revenue, that's all goodness, and you can share the love and people get motivated behind it. And it's through that sort of alignment, you actually can deal with some of the tougher elements where, yes, you may have a function which isn't required anymore because the transformation has digitized it or whatever. And there's no, if you start trying to over finesse it or basically become more opaque about what is probably blatantly evident to a lot of people who are close to or in the program that you're talking about, you're just going to run into trouble because the trust thing goes out the window and people start looking at you going, well, sort of is asking us to do that. Why is he asking us to do that? Sort of what's it going to mean for me? I'm probably, it doesn't. So we actually lean on the side of transparency, but also putting it or articulating it in outcome-based terms rather than we're just here to sort of basically rip up your business or rip up a part of it. And that is very important. But transparency is definitely a key critical success factor in any management consulting firm and how you deliver work. But a lot of the time, I mean, clients or consultants have some pretty shocking reputations, and quite frankly, in some situations I've seen, they deserve it. I mean, I've seen clients who pay a lot of money. People ask you, or the consultants arrive as a sort of a. It's a bit of a stereotype, but consultants arrive, they basically say, Jack, tell me about your business. And you tell me all about your business. And then I write a big, nice big PowerPoint and use some big words and I play it back to you. Jack, this is your business. Okay, that's great. I knew what my business was. So you have that. You have the situation where you've come in and basically there's been a failed transformation or a failed systems implementation. They come in and they spend a lot of money with you to fix it and sort of take it from the disaster it is or the problem it is and move it into something which is successful. And there you get, again, people come in, well, what happened? Well, that's pretty bad. Oh, I'm not sure about that. And you get likened to a bunch of seagulls sort of flying over a harbor yard and everybody's looking up and just getting crapped on. And it's so that there we have some pretty bad reputations to deal with. But if we, and as we do in emphasis, if we articulate what we're doing in terms of an outcome. You're here, we're going to move you to here. And that there is a value associated with that. And if we get you to there, then you pay your bill, which may be quite expensive, but you're going to realize all that value. So you're talking about returns on consulting investment or return on investment in general. And it's a lot easier to digest, but it also lets a client understand that, you know what, they understand what we're trying to do. And if they're prepared to actually put some skin in the game to actually make sure we get there, then there's a lot more buy-in to sort of what you're actually all about. So there's a fair amount of that. But if you look at the situations, there's particularly at the moment, large businesses wanting to put in SAP. There's a limited amount of decent SAP talent on the marketplace. There's pools of it spread around the planet in various firms. We're one of them. So if you sort of, we have a lot of clients who will give us what is called an RFP or a request for a proposal for us to help them screw in a system, SAP in this example. There's the recovery situation where something's gone wrong and they call in us to fix it. And actually those projects are fun. I mean, they're incredibly hard work, but they're quite a lot of fun because when you do fix it, there's a lot of euphoria in the corridors and such. There's thinking projects where you sort of, we don't know what we're, where we really want to head, but we know we've got to head somewhere. Could you help us figure that out? And you'll hear terms like design thinking and co-creation and stuff, which is where you really are getting into proper ideation about sort of solutions or big transformations. And the nice thing about being in a large consulting organization or a large organization such as Infosys is you pretty much have the ability to deliver on those designs anywhere in the world. And we have over 300,000 people all doing very clever things on a day-to-day basis, and as do a lot of the other big firms. And being able to work with a client and really push the needle in creativity, as long as it's tangible and comes out with an outcome, but really push the needle in terms of thinking and execution, knowing that you have the ability to deliver on it is something pretty special. And something that when I started a consulting business and don't get me wrong, that was a very exciting and rewarding 6-7 year journey. But we never had the ability to walk into a big bank, global bank, and say, by the way, we can digitize your bank for you globally. And you can't do that as a small business. Doesn't matter how much you want to.
Was there one or two instances where you went into a company and you just hit it out of the park and you just feel like, wow, we really made a huge difference and just changed the whole trajectory of this company and saved it?
Yeah, it's much saved it. I mean, there's one sort of in recent times where there was turning on a plant and the plant had to come online and they came to us to make sure the plant came online on the date they wanted it to come online. And being able to back that up and actually deliver that it makes you feel pretty good. Now, I can let you know that we not only did that, but we delivered it completely remotely during COVID. So we never showed up at the client site. It was all done digitally. When we sold the initial piece of work to this client and then COVID hit, I went, oh, this isn't going to be good. And I was terrified. And my team just stepped up and delivered on, we're not talking a small piece of work here, a $50 million project. And they delivered it over COVID fully remotely. I mean, that just never been done before. In fact, in most large systems implementations, if you said to a client, by the way, I'm not showing up for the 2 years this is going to take, and it's all going to be done sort of across Teams or Zoom or whatever, I think they'd probably have thrown you out of the office pre-COVID.
Right.
Now they look at it and go, yeah, I'm all over that. Our expense bill just dropped. I don't have to pay for all you guys to be in hotels or fly in here or do whatever. This is all goodness. And by the way, I can get you anytime, day or night. So I just got to sort of ping you on Teams. Yeah, I like that too. So there's sort of big swings or pluses and minuses about the whole thing. But if you want to sort of, in terms of something that I'm extremely proud of, that sort of execution it makes you feel very good. And so this particular client, they turned on their facility on time on the date they wanted to do it, and it was all done fully remotely, never been done before.
See, no, I appreciate that anecdote, right? Because there's this kind of famous Steve Jobs quote. He gave a lecture at a university, and he was criticizing consultants, saying, "Oh, well, they never do anything tangible." You know, they have the best job in the world where they come into a company, fly by night, they parrot back what you say to them, they tell you what you want to hear, and they never have to take responsibility because they give their recommendations and they never have to put it out to action, right? They just fly off to the next client and they're done with you. But what you're saying is actually no, Infosys Consulting, we go in and we make things possible where we can actually point to tangible things and say, oh, you know, no, we actually did that. And I think that part's missing.
Yeah, it's Infosys Consulting and Infosys. I mean, we're basically leveraging the whole sort of what is the $18 billion business. And so it's because it's that scale, we have the ability to do that. But I'd also say, I mean, the other firms can do it as well. It's just you everybody has a bad day at the office occasionally, and you have to make sure you can identify those bad days quickly and do something about it quickly. But I think in this day and age, I mean, the client today is a lot smarter than they were 20, 40 years ago, or whatever. And I'd say to all my clients, if you don't think we're doing a good job, come and tell me. And if you're really that hacked off, then tell us we're out of that. It's we have a responsibility to hit, make sure that you know and feel you're getting value for money. And if you're not, then quite frankly, I don't want to be around, because all it's going to end up with is you being pissed off, and I'm going to not only sort of lose a client, I'm going to take a black eye in the market. I don't want that to happen.
I wonder, from the outside, Andrew, it looks like it would be a really great time for your business, given what's happening with the ascension of artificial intelligence and companies trying to figure out what do we do, how do we implement it, how do we have guidelines around it. With all the banks, particularly here in the US, there's a lot of fear about a banking contagion. I think it's a little better than it was if we had this conversation, you know, a month ago, yeah. But it's still very concerning. And where there are worries about, you know, a recession and what have you. So I'd imagine your services would be in demand because there's so many new evolving things coming together that need to be addressed.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, so the need is definitely increasing. And so people want to digitize, they want to figure out what this thing called generative AI is all about. Mm-hmm. There may be more fundamentals. They want to take cost out because the top line shrinking, you do, whether we like to admit it or not, there is a global recession sort of in motion, and we can see it because our clients are dialing back the volume and just coming a lot more conservative as they make big investment decisions, be it around systems or infrastructure or expansion in general. So yes, I think there is an underlying belief, there is a need to keep moving sort of the agenda. And in fact, it is somewhat self-created, because if you are large company A and you see your competitor, large company B, undertaking a large digital transformation and you're not, if they pull it off, then they are going to get sort of gain that competitive edge that you haven't got. So there's some of it self-created. There's the fear of doing nothing. I think it's, my kids talk to me about FOMO or whatever, but there is a fear of missing out in business as well. If you don't stay on the sort of the hamster wheel and keep pedaling as fast as you can, you may lose an edge to your competition. But the recession is a reality, and there is less free capital or free cash flow available to actually invest in these big transformational projects. So while they're still going on, I think we're seeing clients get a bit more selective in terms of sort of what ones they're going to do first versus later. And I mean, COVID times, it was just bring it on. We got to go digital and fully resilient and flexible right now. So we'll do it all at once. But in today's world, I think there's not only some of the hangover of sort of COVID-free spending, but there's also the reality of the recession. And that is forcing clients to prioritize what they're undertaking. It's hopefully prioritization done because of looking at value propositions and the outcomes they're seeking to get to. But there is that prioritization, Jack. And so with that, if they used to spend 100 million last year on technology, they're probably very unlikely to spend the same again this year. It's actually going down. But it will come back. And so with us, we tend to take a far longer term view than the here and now. We actually look over across multiple years. We know that banks have to transform. We know that supply chains have to, having gone extremely extended, have come back to sort of building sort of strength and robustness or resiliency in them. They're now having to get more efficient again, which means they're spreading out again. And so what am I saying? Change is a part of business, and change is good for consulting, because consultants are very good at managing people, helping people manage through change. The issue at the moment is that there's just a pullback on budgets to actually pay for it. It's like, I mean, I would love to drive around in a Ferrari, but I haven't got the cash to do it. So it's going to remain on my screensaver for a bit until we get.
So it's a little bit of a catch-22. So they need the help. Let's say you have the banks where they were long duration and all of a sudden they're like, wait a minute, you know, we're sitting on billions, some of these banks, billions in unrealized losses. We need help. What do we do? How do we navigate it? But they might not have the money to bring in the talent, to bring in the consultants to say, hey, let's figure it out. Same thing what you're saying with supply, you know, chain. All of a sudden, it feels like here in the US, we're trying to say, maybe we can't rely on China too much. So now we have to have new supply chains. And again, that's going to cost money and time. So I guess, is that where you come in as a senior, you know, leader to try to figure out how you can do it on their budgets and make it happen?
Absolutely. I mean, it's trying to figure out their appetite for change and where they're going to get the biggest bang for the buck. But there's another piece of it, though. So if you look at banking in particular, so banks have, the large banks particularly, have a huge infrastructure of legacy systems which are written decades ago. I mean, in languages called COBOL, which you wouldn't come across particularly at the moment or in this day and age. And while they would love to basically pick up all that infrastructure, throw it out the window and go to a new sort of highly agile, sort of modern tech stack on a sort of partial cloud or hybrid cloud type solution, which sort of mitigates risk, operating risk for them in the long term, to get from where they are today on that sort of mainframe architected structure to a modern structure is pretty scary. Because the problem with these large transformational projects, things do go wrong. And as a bank, something going wrong is not good, really not good. And so yes, you'll find a lot of people in the banking profession who would love to have a conversation about transformation and updating their core infrastructure from stuff from 20, 30 years ago to modern times. But the risk that represents is immense. And so you've got to, and this is part of where we come in, or other consulting firms come in, is trying to figure out how you decouple or uncouple or unbundle that fairly big mess of infrastructure, which looks expensive, looks complicated, is complicated, but stands the bank up today and everything they want to do, and how to sort of pull it apart in bits and morph it over to something sort of more modern, more efficient, and probably more resilient at the end of the day. So they all get the reason and they all have the desire to do it, but the risk profile of doing it is intense. And that's where part of it, our job is to figure out how we mitigate that risk or design a path which mitigates the risk of transformation in as far as we can. So it's not just deliver something or run something for us, it's actually helping clients through some very tough decision trees, be it risk, be it sort of budget oriented, be it sort of shareholder oriented. There's a whole variety of different levers that clients come to us with and saying, look, this is, here's the situation, I need help in thinking through how to deal with it. And then depending on sort of what the situation is and what the outcome is, we'll probably determine what sort of consulting firm, going back to your first question, that you need to help you get there. So if you're talking about how do I increase my market share, Emphasis Consulting is not going to help you do that. We're not market strategists. We know how to implement things which will help you do that, but you're probably going to end up going to a McKinsey type for that type of sort of strategic thinking. And then as you look to operationalize it, yes, you probably start coming to the more Emphasis type firms to actually implement and run it.
You know, more I'm hearing you speak about this, I'm going back to what Rick was saying about when management consultants come in, the knee-jerk reaction might be, oh no, we have to worry. But now I'm thinking just the opposite now, is that if I'm working at a company and I know we have Cobalt or whatever that's really antiquated, and I've been bugging my boss, we should change something, they're not, I'm going to embrace someone like yourself and your team coming in, because I'm saying, thank you, I need an outside third party to say, yes, this has to change. And it wasn't able to do it internally. And sometimes, does it make sense? Like, you need that external third, you know, party to say, yeah, you have to do something. We have to do this quickly. You know, we'll try it. We'll have it on the budget you need, but you can't keep going on like this. And then it carries more weight from the outside person than people who are internally, you know, griping about it for years.
Well, there's two ends of that. So the first one is that if you're the COBOL programmer and I show up going, by the way, I'm going to blow up your COBOL systems and write them in whatever, you're not going to be overly supportive because you're going to be out of the job or you're going to have to retrain. So you do actually, you figure out how to put a value proposition in front of the legacy workforce, which says, look, yeah, you're here. We're going to go over here and we're going to help you move your skill set or sort of reskill you from what you've done for years to what you need to do for years forward. And that is a big part of, I suppose, the sort of how do you walk in and not alienate people, everybody in the business from day one. The business side of it will sort of look at you and it's very easy. So, and having been on the sort of CEO of a business myself and other portfolio businesses, when you're inside the business, even at a CEO level, going to a board and you go, by the way, I've seen this situation, I'm looking at this and it's not where I want it to be, I need it to be over here. And they look at you and go, yeah, Andrew, that's interesting, whatever. And there'll be a dialogue and you go backwards and forwards and it'll probably take a bit of time to convince them and you may be able to convince them. But if you go, well, I think this is bad, we need to move from here to here. And by the way, here's my McKinsey consultant who I basically hired to help me think through this. And they come in and go, McKinsey go, yep, McKinsey thinks that's a good idea too. It brings an additional gravitas to not only just the situation, but also what you're probably talking about. And there are numerous times where consultants, not just us in Emphasis, but consultants broadly get brought in to bring an objective sort of outside in opinion. Where we run into trouble is where you already know that opinion. But even in those cases, if someone's prepared to put their stamp on that opinion saying, yes, we agree with it, it does bring a bit more weight. I'll give you another example. So in the private equity world, when as a technical consulting firm, a private equity company or a private equity fund is looking to buy a business, they typically will undertake what they call technology diligence. They want to make sure that the technology platform or the business they're buying is fit for purpose and it hasn't got anything which is going to represent risk to the investment. So you go in and you basically do the diligence for this fund, which they pay you for. You write your report and they go, yep, that's all good. Thank you very much. Is it release and rely? And you go, well, what's that? And you go, well, it's, can we put your name on it? Because when we go to syndicate this deal with a bank who's going to basically put debt into this deal, we want to have someone, a throat to choke, or someone we're going to point a finger at if it goes wrong from the bit you've just done diligence on, which, by the way, is what we paid you for. So there's part of that. It's that.
You get both sides. You get the good housekeeping seal of approval when they bring you in, but at the same time, if something goes wrong, Hey, it's Andrew's team. We didn't do it.
So, and I think part of as you go through your career as a consultant, you learn to assess risk. And so I'm not an insurance agent or insurance broker or a carrier. I'm a management consultant. So if you're wanting to get insurance for something, you need to go to a different type of profession.
And you have that
dialogue. But when you start off your consulting career, you're very much in a, well, you're seeing loads of cool things. You're doing cool things all the time. Loads of people asking you to do things, and you just get on with it. It's uncomplicated. But as you migrate up through a consulting career, you actually have to take more and more responsibility for your actions and those of others. And you tend to get a bit more discerning of what you're actually going to sign up to do. Doesn't matter what the price is and what you're not. And we get into sort of the example I just said. If they're looking to buy an insurance policy, they need to go speak to Lloyd's of London, not Andrew Duncan at Infosys.
Can you walk us through the different types of roles available at Infosys Consulting or management consulting firms? Because surely it's not just the management consultants that, you know, actually go on site and speak to the executives and speak to the other business stakeholders. What does a typical management consulting company look like in terms of staff and functions?
That's good. They're really good questions, Rick. So a consulting firm, for the most part, I mean, I'm going to be a bit general here, but the top layer is partners or vice presidents, or some people call them managing directors, but it's the top of the stack, top of the pyramid. And most consulting firms are pyramid shaped. And so you get partners, associate partners, directors. As you go down the pyramid, there's a leverage ratio. So you start growing out junior. So you have a lot more junior staff than you do partners as a result. There are other companies which actually are more of a diamond shapes. They have less junior staff, a lot of sort of people in the mid ranks, and then still the partner team at the top. And they do different things. So if you are doing wholesale systems integration, you are probably going to want to recruit a lot of people at the sort of coming out of their undergrad degrees, giving them some experience, using them because they're all smart, they've all got their degrees, and using them. It's a very efficient proposition. You've got a lot of brain power at a fairly low price. And it's sort of what feeds the bottom of the pyramid. If the next layer up, you're getting into sort of a senior consulting part. And a lot of those individuals may have actually gone to B school and have come back from B school. And so they've taken their technology, I'm talking from an emphasis context here, they've taken their base business consulting skills or their base technology consulting skills, and they've layered on an MBA training on top. And those individuals become quite interesting. The problem is for an emphasis is our proposition for a B school graduate, certainly Ivy League, is a lot less compelling than it is to get than McKinsey's, who are going, hey, we're McKinsey, this is what we do, this is, well, look, you're going to have a great career and you'll end up as sort of CEO of Goldman's or whatever. It's a very, very attractive carrot. For an emphasis, typically we're not hiring from an Ivy League, so we're going to a more core business school, but we're also looking for a more pragmatic approach to their professional career. We're not looking for people who feel owed. We want people to participate and really enjoy the journey that they're on through their consulting career. But to go back to your question, so you have consultants, which typically are your undergrad layer, senior consultants, and what we call principals, but you're beginning to, what those people look like, they're beginning to manage people. I think it's the easiest way to look at it. So you start at the bottom, you're managing no one except yourself, typically. And as you gain experience, you start managing people, you then start managing teams, you then start managing sort of particularly projects or engagements for clients, and then you actually may end up managing clients. Partners, for the most part, and associate partners will manage client relationships. And so they are the sort of the point of contact or the throat to choke for the client. And it's their responsibility to go in and develop those relationships, not just with an individual, but within multiple individuals within the account. The associate partners, the same thing, but associate partners would tend to, or sort of junior managing directors, put it on in Accenture type terminology, are expected, yes, in some circumstances to manage relationships with clients, but also to manage the delivery of big complicated engagements with large teams. You then have below that senior managers, directors, call them what you will, we call them principals and senior principals. And they are very, very capable people who not only run teams, they may be very specialist in their particular area. They may be delivering a certain type of transformation, but it's a combination of what they know, what they've done, and the style in which they manage teams and deliver outcomes. The more and more valuable those become, the higher up the pyramid you get. But long-winded way. So there are two types of long-winded answer. Two types of firm. There's a pyramid, which is pure leverage model. Bring people in at the bottom, and as they grow through their career, you end up as a partner at the top. And then there's the diamond, where you bring in, and which is where Emphasis Consulting is, where we bring in less people at the bottom, and we look for more people with experience, be it B-school experience or career experience, and then we grow them up from there. But it's at the top of the game is this partner rank or a managing director rank or vice president rank, depending on what sort of business you're with. And you are expected to not only sell revenue, you're expected to deliver complex programs, you're expected to have or drive thought leadership into the marketplace, you're expected to be engaged with the market, similar to sort of conversations like this. You're meant to be visible, you're meant to be eminent. And that's a big part of being at the top of the game in consulting.
No, I appreciate you painting that picture, right? Because I think there is this common misconception, especially within the blind community, that management consulting is exactly that kind of pyramid structure where, oh, it's great when you're out of college or you're out of business school. But you know, if you have spent time in the industry, perhaps it's not the right fit for you. And that's why I was so attracted to your experience, because you were an electrical engineer, actually having done work in your function, being a subject matter expert within your discipline, and being able to apply that, right? So I can imagine, you know, something more close to blind, where you might have spent maybe a decade or you know, 5 years even, as an engineer with a cloud computing service giant, you know, an Amazon or a Google. And there's these kind of legacy or older companies that want so desperately to transform digitally, and they need that cloud expertise, where, you know, a consulting company can point to you and your background, your track record that's proven, and say, hey, look, you know, Rick and Jack, he's been in Amazon, he's worked on Amazon Web Services, and that's the exact kind of technology that you want to implement. We have kind of an inside guide. And that makes that kind of experience or that consulting firm a bit more compelling in terms of their pitch, so to speak.
To a degree. I mean, I always advise clients not to buy individuals. I mean, they need to buy. Buying individuals is dangerous because the individuals could decide to do something else at some point in time. And if you've hung your whole transformation on John Smith, it's going to be when John decides to go join another business. So you're buying outcomes from organizations. And now, don't get me wrong, a big part, and having been on the buying side of consulting as well, a big part of it, you are buying people to a degree. You want to see people come through the door that you believe or have a trust that they know what they're doing, they know your industry, they know they've done this before several times, and that's what you're buying. But right. you can ascertain that pretty quickly. I mean, you can sitting down as a consumer goods person or talking about retail logistics, and they start going on about some banking system, then it's not going to make you feel particularly good about their knowledge around retail logistics. So you can figure out their industry or sector content pretty quickly, and then you can ask them what they've done before. And the nice thing is, because the client community is fairly open as well, you can call people and go, look, I'm looking at using Emphasis, or I'm looking at using Accenture. They say they did a great job for you, and they'll call them and call the CIO or even the CEO or the chairman and go, so are they that good? And hopefully the answer will be yes, they are. And sort of that trust starts getting to be built. But back to your point though, I would, and even as a buyer of consulting sort of through my career at various points, I would never be buying people. I'd want people with content and having done it before, but that specific individual, not so much.
Interesting. Now, are there any kind of critical roles that Emphasis is seeking to hire right now or in the future?
We hire across sort of through the structure. So we look to hire partners all the time. And the reason we do that is professional services, and I'm not just consulting, but any professional services, it's basically pure maths. Partners are designed or intended to sell and deliver X million of business. And so if you want to grow the business, you need to have more partners because blended, so if you give you an example, if you've got partners who are one partner equates to about $10 million worth of business, and you want to deliver a $100 million or $1 billion practice, you're going to need 100 partners. It's pure maths. And I'd love to say it was more nuanced than that, and a lot more. It's just pure maths. But you need partners who bring with them networks and have the quality to both know how to sell properly, but also how to deliver properly. So we hire partners. We hire associate partners. And we like those because it gives us the opportunity to actually promote people at a point in their career to partnership. And being promoted to partner in any business is an important step. It really, really is. And it's something which you realize, you go, whoa, hang on a second, I've achieved the sort of a significant level within our business. So hiring associate partners is very good news. And actually then the juniors, we tend to hire out of, we do quite a bit of graduate or undergrad recruiting, depending on what geography you're looking at. So India would be a good example where we do a fair amount of undergrad. We also do a lot of grad recruiting though, sort of MBA recruiting, again, in India as again. We also do it in the States. And so we look at sort of the bottom end of the diamond sort of situationally. And there are times where we hire a lot more people, say, out of undergrad than we do 1 year compared to another. So it is a bit circumstantial depending on what we're looking at as a business, but we love, absolutely love the senior consultant, senior principal type recruiting. The other thing, and I'm just being very candid here, DE&I is a big topic in this day and age. I mean, sort of diversity and systems or the whole systems world, if you look back historically, has not been the friendliest place as a female to have a career. But all consultancies are dealing with the diversity issue and the inclusion and equality issues as well. And it is brutally hard to fix, particularly if you have been predominantly a male business in the past, switching it to a female business like that doesn't happen. And so recruiting through all levels of the organization, I actually welcome with open arms because not only allows us to bring in fresh talent and of quality, but also it helps me sort of increase my diversity in what is, I'm afraid to say, has been a historically a very male-oriented business. And we are looking to move away from that as fast as we can, but you have to do it within limitations and recruiting gives you one of those channels. Then going back to the promotion of people, if I can bring in a diverse workforce through the recruiting program and then recruit them or promote them through their careers, then I'm ticking a variety of boxes and it's actually helping me develop more better diversity in my senior leadership and such. So recruiting is a key part of it, but we recruit across all levels. There are certain situations where we're looking for a particular type of talent, but probably the most success we have is with people who've been around to the business for at least a couple of years. But if you're going to get people to a point they've got a couple of years experience, you've got to recruit them. So, but it's not expecting too much of them too quickly. You've got to let them get their feet to a degree.
No, I appreciate that. And it seems like you recruit across many geographies as well. It's truly a worldwide business.
Yeah. We recruit across the world pretty much all the time. And I'm down in Australia in a couple of weeks with some of our junior staff down there. I'm in Dallas in a couple of weeks, or actually about a month, where we do a lot of recruiting in the Dallas, sort of in that whole area around Plano, Richardson, which is where we have one of our hubs, New York in a couple of weeks. I mean, we recruit literally all over the world at scale. I mean, I think last year, you'd want to check this, but I mean, Infosys as a business, I think, hired about 50,000 people last year.
Wow.
Yeah. Just to put it in perspective, we hire an enormous amount of people all over the world every year.
Amazing.
But that's not just Infosys, that's all big tech businesses. The numbers are astonishing.
Wow, I really appreciate this like inside look into management consulting, but also Infosys, because, you know, I think it's just an industry that, along with professional services, you know, people have an understanding of what they do on like a very, I would say, superficial level, right? Like lawyers interpret law, accountants like go through your books, right? Consultants kind of help you through the next stage of your process, but not really the like actual like nuts and bolts. So Andrew, thanks for being so generous with your time and walking us through that.
Well, I'll give you one thing, last point to that, Rick.
Please.
Really, really, really important. And a lot of people would say, oh, Infosys, they're an offshore outsourcing business. And they're largely correct. But if you look at offshore outsourcing businesses, whether it's process, technology, outsourcing, infrastructure, doesn't matter, an offshore outsourcing business, there are two fundamental types of that sort of business. There is a Western business that has gone to India, and there is an Indian business that has gone West. And Infosys is the latter. And that's a really, really important differentiation. So if you look at a Western business, and I had one which went to India, you bring with you a Western culture, a Western mentality, a Western sort of, I don't want to be overly generic here, but a more capitalistic foundation. So you are all about results. It's all about sort of getting as efficient as possible, growing as fast as possible, delivering the result. An Indian business that has gone West actually brings with it the culture of India. A lot more socialist, a lot more sort of family orientation, a lot more sort of giving back into the community. Now, I'm not saying Western businesses aren't family and don't have social values and stuff, but an Indian business, just by definition that they are an Indian business, has that DNA embedded in the business from day one. So and something that I've really experienced in my Infosys career, and this is true of any Indian business, that you have it's an unbelievable family feeling that you're doing this for more than just pure economics and pure capitalist output. You're actually, I mean, a big part of Infosys is we employ huge amounts of the Indian population to do all sorts of things for the business. Some of them are maybe money generating and actually make sense. Some of them may not be money generating and make less sense, but it doesn't matter. We take a community view to it. And if you look at some of if you read about the culture and and what makes India India, really, really important. And you can see that vividly in a business like Infosys, that you probably are not going to see so much in a Western business that has gone to India. Really, really important differentiation. Now, the downside of that is that, and unfortunately being British, I have to take some of the blame here, is that the British and their relationship with India, one of the things we left in India was this wonderful bureaucracy and a lot of paperwork and a lot of, and unfortunately the sort of with India comes a lot of process and hierarchy and such. And some of it to a Western business person could actually become very frustrating. But I tell people in Infosys who do get frustrated, having come from Western businesses, that you have to understand that your relationship with Infosys is a journey. And you have two ways to look at it. It can be a journey from A to B and you just want to get to B and move on, or it's a journey from A to B and you can enjoy the journey on the way.
Wow.
And if you can enjoy the journey on the way, and it may not all go swimmingly to plan and it could get frustrating as hell from time to time, then yeah, Infosys is probably the right sort of company for you. If you just want to get to A to B and get to B, join the Western business that goes to India, because they'll be all over that. But a lot of the things we do at Infosys, there are moments where I do bang my head against the wall occasionally. But you step back from it and you realize that it's a journey. You'll get to where you need to get to. And you sort of go with the flow to a degree. And that's part of what I love about our business. And you're allowed to do that. It's not, you can't just go sort of, you can't get to a position where your productivity is plummeted or whatever. You've got to have a reason and a purpose for doing it. But you're allowed to be you to get there, and you're allowed to be you with your team. And that is something that over 30 plus years in the industry, not even my own business, but I have that in Infosys, we've got it. And I love it for it.
Got it. Thanks so much, Andrew. I really appreciate that.
That's it for The Blind Ambition. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.